Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Matt Skuda.
Hi, thanks for having me, John.
Hi, Matt. Could you introduce yourself and tell everyone out there where they might hear you?
I can. I am Matt Skuda. I am a freelance filmmaker and production assistant and assistant director out in Los Angeles. You can find what I'm up to on my website, mattskuda.com, or like the appropriate social media websites.
Okay. And Matt, you came to me with the suggestion of doing this episode's podcast on Lois Lowry's 1993 novel, The Giver. And this is a book that a lot of people have suggested. It is not a book, however, that existed when I was in high school. I was already in grad school by 1993. But I do know that this book is ubiquitous in middle schools and high schools around the country.
Right, yeah. So I would have read this book in 2005 when I was in 8th grade. So I didn't actually read this in high school. I read it in middle school. And I was interested in kind of discussing this book or having it on your podcast because right now dystopian books or utopian books or post-apocalyptic young adult books are so ubiquitous. I kind of wanted to go back to where you might be able to argue the modern trend started, even though there's probably quite a big gap between The Giver and the modern deluge of books.
Right. This was also around the time when young adult was coalescing into the form it has now. I mean, there obviously were books for young adults earlier, but the whole idea of it as, I think, a marketing idea emerged around this time in the 90s. You know, I think that there were, before that, there were lots of books that were just kind of older chapter books. And it was around this time that I think people really started marketing books to teenagers. It became a big thing. And of course, it became a huge thing by the end of the 90s with Harry Potter.
Right.
My oldest kid read this book, I think, in high school. My younger kid did not read it in high school, but I have seen it on reading lists all over the place. So it's a book that I'm well aware of. And of course it was made into a movie, which I didn't see.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it, unfortunately.
but yeah, so you say you read this in middle school. Was this for a class?
It was for a class. So I had two English type classes my eighth grade year. One was English literature or just English. And the other was reading writing workshop, and this one was assigned in my English class.
This book is probably the most famous book by Lois Lowry, who also wrote, what was her other big book, was Number of the Stars. She has written a lot of books, including more books in the Giver series.
Right, there are three more, none of which I've read.
She's well known as a young adult author. As you mentioned, this book is a dystopian novel, and there's so many young adult books now that are dystopian novels. We think of The Hunger Games. You think of, well, other ones, I guess.
Yeah, like we have like The Maze Runner, Z for Zachariah.
Yeah,
just two off the top of my head.
When I was a kid, I remember the series that I loved was the White Mountains series by John Christopher. But those were not so much dystopian as they were post-alien invasion stories. So I guess they did have a sort of a society that the aliens had set up on Earth that was dystopian. Anyway, so this is in many ways a kind of a 1984 for kids.
Right. Yeah, definitely like an introduction to the dystopian novel. Because like we were kind of speaking before the podcast, how it is kind of a base level utopian / dystopian society. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of meat to it.
It's an interesting take on a dystopian society insofar as I was reading it, it left me with a lot of questions. I mean, when you read 1984, you understand where that's coming from. That's coming from a fear of the kind of totalitarian regimes that seemed to have been ushered in by the Soviet Union. And if you read Brave New World, you see that as a fear of a world that is governed by new advancements in medical engineering and psychological theories of human development. In this book, I just didn't quite see how we got to here, because it kind of posits a world in which there are no more memories. And that's also kind of confusing as to what that actually means, because obviously people can function. They remember the names. They can do their work. They just have no collective cultural memories, and they're kind of encouraged to give up anything that's like a personal memory. And how that society emerges, what the forces are moving from the present day to this day, are never really explained.
No, you're right. And that was something that was, I think, frustrating to me at the time, and it is frustrating to me now, but I'm able to kind of write it off in a way. Because like we were saying with Brave New World and 1984, and I think it's most similar to Brave New World if we were to compare it to one of the two. But those books, like you said, are kind of very specific in terms of depicting consequences of like a current trend, whether that's like a government, or if it's a like, you know, meds coming in, or the type of entertainment that's coming in. And then whereas The Giver is a lot more like, I mean, it really is just, it's like, it's beyond any current trend. It's not like a worse version of this or that. It's just kind of what it is. But what it is, I think, is actually kind of a metaphor for being in school. And I think that's why it resonates with like young kids. Like, I don't think there's necessarily like there's an A to B, and it's not warning of anything to come. But it is going like, hey, kids, isn't it a bummer that you're in a highly regimented system, which is school, which kind of, you know, your day is completely lined out for you. When you eat lunch at this time, you have 6 or 7 or 8 classes, and you go at this time, you're in, you're out, passing time, very little, like tons of homework. If your parents are still telling you what to do, you know, maybe you're not allowed to travel, like, you know, bike around your town and explore. Maybe you're kept to like your yard or your neighborhood or whatever. And I think this book is kind of going, hey, what, it's important to go beyond that. And I think kids know that. And I don't think this book is saying anything profound, but I think it resonates with kids, because you're like, yeah, like the system is bogus. We need to,
what I thought of when I was reading it through was what really resonates to teenagers is the idea that grown-up life is about conformity and about squashing emotion. And when you're a teenager, of course, you're just in the grips of ridiculously out of control emotion at all times.
Right.
And the sort of romanticism that this book has about the idea that our individuality is a product of our memory, and our memory makes possible strong emotions, which could either be very pleasant emotions or they could be very painful emotions, but at least they're real. And that's being held up in contrast to a society that really devalues individualism, really devalues any kind of caring about anything. And so I can see that that would really resonate with teenagers. But then there's this weird mechanism of lost memory, and how that happens is not really explained much in the book.
Right. Or not at all, really. It's just like, it's like I mean, the movie actually opens with like a some title cards that just kind of explain it away, like in a line. Like, there are no memories. One person in the city collects all these memories for everyone and experiences all that pain. And even that, like, without the context of the book, I felt would make very little sense to anyone reading it. I have the quote here. So it's, all memories of the past were erased. Like, that's how the movie begins. And and the book begins that way too. I mean, it goes into it a little bit more, but it's not, there's no mechanism for how memories were erased. There's no mechanism for how the memories are stored and given to the receiver. And I think, I mean, do you think, how much do you think the book would have benefited from that? Or do you think that would have been a distraction from the kind of main thrust of the story?
Part of what I struggle with this book, again, reading this as an adult, since it didn't exist when I was a kid, and trying to imagine this, reading this book as a kid, the thing that I keep coming back to is the book kind of wants to have it both ways, insofar as there's a sort of a pseudoscientific aspect to what's going on here, and then there's a kind of a mystical aspect of what's going on here. We are told that everyone in this community, they call it the community that they live in, has to be given medications which both dull the libido, because they're given to teenagers at the point that they start to have sexual feelings, but also seem to perhaps aid in the suppression of memories. But the other way in which emotions are suppressed is through talk therapy, almost. It's kind of the families sit around at night and discuss their days in sort of the way you would discuss it with therapist. And I found that a little bit distasteful in a way, because I thought that there was a part of this book that sounded to me to be kind of profoundly sort of psychology, sort of anti-psychiatry, because there's this sense that these kinds of therapies may help people to feel, to not feel bad emotions, but they end up having people feel no emotions. And that's often a charge that was levied against, say, antidepressants. And I know that this book came out in 93, around the time everyone was reading Prozac Nation. When did that come out, Prozac Nation?
It came out in 1994, so the same year as The Giver.
Yeah, so I know that, I remember around this time there was a lot of discussion about medication, particularly as it related to depression and as it related to child behavior, because there was a lot of concern that people were overprescribing drugs for children. And I kind of get the feeling that this book is part of that reaction to those criticisms.
That makes sense. That kind of brings me to Jonas's friend Asher. So I think to kind of introduce Asher, you should do like a quick background. Like, so Jonas, like the main character in the book, is a 11, soon to be 12-year-old, effectively. One of his best friend is Asher, who's kind of like a bit of a goofball, like vaguely a troublemaker. Maybe would be considered a class clown if he existed in this world, but in the suppressed world of The Giver, not so much. But he was someone who, like when he was younger, was punished with a like a hitting implement in order to kind of make sure he's speaking succinctly and correctly. And that was one of the, honestly, the most frustrating parts of this book for me as someone who, you know, when I was younger and still do, I, you know, talked a lot. Mm-hmm. And not always in a way that was offensive, but maybe just like a little manic.
When I read a lot of reviews of this book, they all say it starts out as though the community is a utopia, but then it becomes apparent that it is a dystopia. And I thought, who the hell thinks this is a utopia from the beginning? It seems to me like it bends over backwards to point out the problems with the society, and one of the problems is that all individuality is either drugged out of you or beaten out of you, as in the case of Asher, and the characters have to undergo humiliations. If they feel strong emotions, they are directed to report those emotions and then apologize to the person that they have bad feelings towards. So, and Asher is made to be publicly humiliated at the ceremony where everybody is given their assignments, because in this crazy world, at the age of 12, everyone is given the job they will have for the rest of their life. That's another way that conformity is assured. But it's such a weird dystopia, because the worst thing you can do in this dystopia is to be rude to somebody, and that's really frowned upon. That's why strong emotions are kept down, is this whole idea that nothing can be unpleasant in this world. And that again reminds me of around this time was when I think the height of complaints about political correctness came out, and the idea that you always had to watch your speech and everything. And the feeling I got as I was reading this description was it's sort of a hodgepodge of different complaints about American society, that people were trying too hard to be polite, that people were trying too hard to avoid strong emotions, that everything in life was seen as therapeutic.
Right.
It was so kind of diffuse in its criticisms that I wasn't quite sure what the Lois Lowry's point of view really was. It was kind of like a mix and match of complaints, and a lot of them seemed a little bit reactionary to me.
No, I definitely agree. In terms of, I was thinking about because there's kind of the modern discussion of political correctness in this kind of annoying political climate. Because we have people going, like, you know, we have Trump, who's kind of the exact opposite of what it means to be politically correct. And obviously this book is not arguing for a world where, like, everyone acts like Donald Trump.
Right.
But it's also not arguing for a world where everyone keeps their opinions and thoughts to themselves, because, I mean, it doesn't necessarily say this in the book, but I think it's an easy inference to make, is, like, the world is static. And, like, that static state is a massive problem in terms of like what makes life worth it.
Yeah, that I think that in the end, that's the only thing that makes the community a dystopia, is there is no ultimate meaning to anyone's life. In 1984, the threat is you will be crushed, you know, physically and spiritually, and ultimately killed by the totalitarian government that rules you at its whims. In this world, it's sort of that the tragedy is you will end up living a life that has no meaning for yourselves, because you're too busy being the same as everyone else, and that individuality is the only thing that gives meaning, or that bad emotions are the only thing that give pleasurable emotions. I mean, it's a kind of a, maybe I'm simplifying too much here, but the,
I don't think so.
Now, as we've mentioned, the main character, Jonas, he's identified as being different from everyone in the society because he has clear eyes, whereas everyone else has dark eyes.
Oh, so yeah, pale eyes. Yeah.
Pale eyes, right. He has pale eyes. And he, because of this, he is able to see beyond. And through the first part of the book, we're given these little momentary glimpses that he can see the world differently than other people. And it's not, Lowry doesn't really explain what that means until later in the book. she spells it out that he is able to briefly see color, whereas nobody else in this society can see color as a side effect of living an affectless life. And this is another one of these moments of the book that I think, well, that's a kind of a lovely metaphor. It doesn't really make sense from any kind of a scientific perspective. So again, I'm left wondering, as a reader, I'm fine with magical realism on the one hand, and I'm fine with science fiction on the other hand, but this is kind of both.
Yeah, and like and neither one really has like a payoff.
Right.
Like it's when it comes down to it, it's like, oh, it's kind of a cool reveal, because like when you're reading the book, you have no way of knowing that the characters only see in like black and white or whatever. And then once you kind of realize he's seeing in color, it's kind of a cool reveal, just because it's, you know, not something you're thinking about. But at the same time, it's like that really doesn't seem to serve like an important function in this society. I mean, it's like, that's my biggest problem with like some of the things this book is, like some of the things they do, or the things they take away from. Like, I mean, like, no hills, no wind, no color. And it's just like, I mean, it's like, it seems like kind of we're talking about, like, what's the slippery slope that led us here? Like, there's no way you can envision what that would even be.
Right. Well, this is the Sturt Wellington, the Purge problem, which is
right.
The Purge problem, which is, yes, this is a horrible way to run a society. Wouldn't it be horrible if this horrible thing that we made up were true?
Yeah. So, like, yeah, exactly. I think you talked about, like, you talked about the Purge and also like Vice and the Hunger Games. It's like he introduces you. It's like, here's this terrible world that it's, and then they, it's objectively terrible, and then they try to make an argument for why it's terrible. Right. It's like, I mean, it's, what are you trying to convince us of? And I think that's why it's more effective for maybe younger readers, because they're not necessarily thinking about things in those like kind of abstract terms. But
for me, it works better when I feel as though it's trying to make poetic truth. When the poetic truth is, if you don't have strong emotions, you can't see colors, or the poetic truth of these memories. Again, the weirdness of this society is, there's this one person who's in charge of having all the memories, and it's not just his memories, it's the memories of all humankind. And memories in this world just kind of float there freely in the world until they find a home in someone's head, because if the receiver who has all these memories decided to let them go, they would float back out into the world and people would just pick them up.
Right. And it's not totally unlike like the Pensieve in Harry Potter, where like a memory is not like a big, vast, kind of intangible thing. It's like a memory is a specific memory. It's like the first memory we're introduced to is like a boy on a sled riding down a hill. And then as we kind of go on, those memories evolve into like more painful things, like a boy sledding down an icy hill, breaking his arm, feeling pain that no one in the society has ever felt, because pain is completely purged from the society. But it's also more like, even beyond that, it's memories of war, memories of loss, but also like positive memories like the warmth of family, you could argue religion, among other things.
The reason we're given in this book that the society, again called the community, wants there to be at least one person who holds on to these memories is because from time to time a crisis will arise and they will have no idea what to do with it unless they turn to the receiver and ask him about it. And because he has memory, he can dip back into this sort of collective human experience and say, oh, that's a good idea, or oh, that's a bad idea. But the weirdness of that is, I don't know how the rest of the people would even know that that was a good idea, given that they have no memories. And again, as you mentioned, memories are sort of a slippery concept. They are, as the giver, the receiver, the old gentleman who is giving these memories to Jonas is now becoming the giver, and Jonas is becoming the receiver. As those memories go along, they are these very specific memories of a very specific person at a very specific time. They're not like an intangible feeling of love or an intangible feeling of courage or whatever. They are a specific moment where somebody had love or courage. And I just don't understand how the rest of the society, why they value this gentleman if they actually have none of these memories. And again, I don't know what it means to not have these memories. It's more as though people do have memories of their own lives. It's just that they attach no affect to those memories. They attach no judgment to those memories.
Well, again, I kind of going back to like what function anything in this book serves to the story or the community or whatever. Like the only person the receiver of memory kind of answers to is like the committee of elders, and they're the ones who get like a question from the community. It's like, hey, can 6-year-olds be allowed to ride bicycles? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And then it's like they're like that question would go unanswered for years and years and years because they would have no way of deciding to answer that. And then they could go to the giver and be like, hey, giver, receiver, should kids be allowed, should 6-year-olds be allowed to ride bicycles? And he could, you know, think about it, go into those memories and find, I mean, a bunch of memories of 6-year-olds falling off and hurting themselves in various ways. And he can go back to the committee and go, no, they should not be allowed to have bicycles. And they're like, great, thank you. And they kind of dish that out. But again, like, that's such a bizarre system because it's like, do these people have like no concept that people fall off bicycles? And they do, because I think they do talk about Jonas scraping his knee one time and comparing that to the pain of having his arm broken or being like dying in war, shot and hungry and thirsty.
Right. Now, I find that interesting what you just said there, because it occurs to me that recently, and I believe in the last 10 years or so, there have been a lot of theories of mind put forward that say that the evolutionary purpose of emotion is that it is a cue to the mind that you need to make a decision really quickly, because there have been situations where people don't have emotions, where because of some fault in the mind, a person doesn't have strong emotions, and what typically happens is those people are unable to make decisions. They sit in front of, say, a couple of boxes of cereal and they just can't choose because nothing seems any more important than the other thing, whereas emotion is a way of the mind telling itself, hurry up and make this decision, or hurry up and make this decision right now because it's really, really important. And I think it's like Lowry is so close to making that claim in this book, but it seems like what she's positing more is that people have just kind of lost knowledge in a way, rather than lost the importance of that knowledge. I don't know.
Right. No, I mean, that definitely makes sense to me. And that wasn't really the way I was thinking about it, but it's definitely true. Cause I kind of imagine the memory as more of like historical context, but,
right.
But the emotional parts are obviously what motivates Jonas to do what he does in like the second and third act of this book.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that's funny about, and weirdly mystical about this, is the way that the giver imparts memories to Jonas as he's giving the community's collected body of memories. He gives them one at a time by placing his hands on Jonas's back, and they are just transferred into his mind
in real time.
Exactly. And so again, there's no clear explanation for this. Whether it takes on this kind of a mystical quality, and I guess I don't mind that if I felt like the book had a better handle on tone if I felt like this was just a world in which that sort of thing happened, I would be happier. But I'm not exactly sure what Lowry wants me to think about this, whether this is, you know, when I was a little kid, there was a Ralph Bakshi film called Wizards, which is a crazy film, but it's one of these 70s films in which in a post nuclear apocalypse, magical creatures have come back to inherit the world, and so once technology gets displaced, suddenly magic comes back into the world. And I kept kind of waiting for that to be an explanation in this book, that somehow, but we don't really know what's happened to the world. You know, they do mention that there's this community and there are other communities out there, maybe. I don't know, because they could also just be a story that the kids are being told about.
Well,
them being...
There are definitely some other communities, because they are visited by the children of other communities, and like one of the very first like things like where Lily has like a grievance that a kid from another community was like cutting in line on the playground.
Right.
So they definitely exist, but I think maybe what you're asking is, are there other communities around, but in the elsewhere, is there an actual world kind of like our own? Is this like a Waco cult that has gone incredibly far, or is the entire world like this?
Yeah, or is this a kind of a Logan's Run world where once you get outside the city, you're in this crazy post-apocalyptic world where people are living in a more of a natural state or something?
Right. I think with that we can probably kind of get into. Kind of the latter half of the story, where Jonas has now received quite a few memories and has kind of this well-rounded context of love and pain and anger and sadness and all those things. And he gets more and more disillusioned by the world he lives in. I mean, he sees his mom, complains about, you know, like a little inconvenience at work. And how it kind of made her sad, and Jonas knows that she really has no idea what sadness really even is, because he's seen kids die on battlefields.
Well, there's that sequence where the other kids are playing a mock game of war, and he can't join in because he knows what a real war is like. And I had to again relate that to it kind of reminded me of. People at this time were very upset about, say, Doom, and violence in video games was a big watchword around this time in the 90s. So it felt again like it was touching on that, maybe.
Right, or even the kind of like the rise of the violent video game graphics got better. Yeah. But something that kind of that the question I asked that again I'm sure doesn't have a good answer, but we can just. Put it out there and kind of call it one of the many problems of this book is how the kids have a concept at all to even come up with the game of war. Like they're holding their hands like guns. How they know what a gun is beyond me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing is that when you posit that that people have no memories at all, I suppose it's sort of like the memento problem. You have to come up with a strong set of rules to govern what it is that a person can actually remember if you're going to posit a character who has no short-term memory. And in this book, nobody has any long-term memory, and yet they function. They don't like wander off out into the cold at night. You know, just,
well, there's no cold in this world, John.
Right.
It's 72 degrees all the time.
But again, the question is who's maintaining that, given the fact that nobody seems to care that much about anything.
Right, and there's also like no sun, which doesn't quite make any sense.
And the other thing that I think is absolutely hilarious is when the kids are given their assignments at age 12. of what they're going to do in this community. And the community, you never really get a sense of how big this is, but I never got the sense that it was much bigger than a few thousand people at most.
Right. So it seems like every age group had about 50 kids. Does that right. sound right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, but
so you could extrapolate out to like 4,000 to 8,000. Yeah.
Yeah. But they, so, but everyone is given a job at this thing, and they are weirdly specific to the point at which later in the book, they're talking about cleaning up after a ceremony, and they said the food gatherers would take away the food. I was thinking, wait, is that their job? They're food gatherers? Is that how you run a community?
Yeah, and they also have like the reserve workers, because they're like, oh, and they're like everyone today has the day off, but it's like, oh no, but there are kids to be taken care of and at the nursery, and there are old people to be taken care of at the House of Old. And they kind of explain that away with, oh, no, there are reserved people for that. And so, well, what are they doing the rest of the time?
Yeah.
It's kind of like every time, like, there's, like, there kind of crops up, like, a little narrative problem in this book, it's kind of written off with another line that doesn't necessarily become a problem for the story, but it's just another problem for the world.
Yeah. That's a very good way of putting it. Now, the main end conflict of the book comes up as Jonas learns that his father, his assignment is to be a nurturer, to take care of newborns from the time that they are born until the time in which they are given to a family, because birth mothers do not take care of their children
That's one of the many other assignments that people are given. They'd be assigned a birth mother for 3 years, and then after that, they would just be a laborer.
Right. And there's no fathers to speak of, so one assumes everyone's getting pregnant via artificial insemination or something. Although,
yeah, maybe we have a weird assignment we never heard of like the sperm donor.
Right. And how they get that to happen, given the fact that they're all on meds, I don't know. Jonah's father is responsible for all these babies, but then Jonah learns that amongst many other things that his father does is he kills when there are identical twins, one of them has to be killed because it would be too confusing for there to be two people who look the same.
Right, which brings us to, and they call that like to be released, and right. it's not only like the twin that would be released, it's also old people, when they get too old to be easily taken care of, they're out of there. And then it's like anyone causing the smallest problem. If someone breaks a reasonably important rule three times, like, they're gone. If there's a baby who is not restful at night, it's released. If there is a twin, you know, we can't handle having two people around, like, that look alike, the lighter of the two is out.
Right.
And the idea is they're released to elsewhere. So that kind of like, you know, from the beginning that this is like a load of BS, but like, they're like, oh, people are released to elsewhere. And it's kind of a celebration for certain people. Like, they celebrate the old who are being released. The young kids who've never been assigned to family are just kind of released without fanfare. But the idea is like they're released to elsewhere where they still exist. And it's not like a concept of heaven. Like, they kind of treat it as an actual other place, which that to me, like, that spoke of how selfish the society was. Cause we're like, okay, when this old person gets just a little bit too difficult to take care of, we release them to elsewhere and they deal with them. They're elsewhere's problem now. And like, and that was like the same with, Gabe, who we haven't talked about at all yet, but one of the newborns that Jonas's father has been taking care of is Gabe, who is a little bit difficult. He's a bit difficult. Like, he's a little bit restless. He also has pale eyes like Jonas, I think, unrelated to him being restless. And he starts taking him home at night so he could kind of keep a closer eye on him. And because he continues to be so restless, they eventually decide he needs to be released. And it's with that And Jonas is now new knowledge that release means euthanized. That he goes, well, now it's time for change.
A couple of points here just to fill in. Jonas has been giving Gabe some of his memories at night, which is, I think, a fascinating idea because, of course, the baby has absolutely no experience to hang these ideas upon. And I wish that in some ways Lowry had developed this a little bit more, because I thought that was a kind of a beautiful, crazy idea, you know, sort of the way that if you ever have kids, one of the things that you learn is that the babies dream in the womb and they dream as newborns, and you just really wonder what the hell could they possibly be dreaming about given that they have no experience. And I thought that this was sort of like that to me. I thought that was, but Lowry didn't really develop that much. Now, Jonas had been planning on leaving the community for a while with the collusion of the Giver. They had come up with a plan where he would leave because the expectation was that when Jonas leaves, all these emotions would go back into the community and the community would be forced to deal with them.
And we know this because 10 years earlier, they had another receiver like Jonas who was overcome with the pain, which was emotional pain, not physical pain, and put in a request to be released, and she was. And when she was released, those memories were unleashed on the community. And it's, again, not at all clear how they wrangled those memories back from them. And also the magnitude of that problem is also not really discussed. You're like, oh, it was like, we don't really know what happened beyond it was a problem.
Right.
Which is annoying, which is kind of annoying because that's for a community that has kind of, again, no context for pain, no context for immense joy. Like when that's piled on them suddenly, and then this person who is the previous receiver, a lot of her memories were emotional pain, not physical pain, because the Giver could not stand to give her physical pain. So then you have like all this emotional pain unleashed on the town or the community, but we never get an idea at all about how that was resolved.
Right.
Which is annoying, because they talk about, again, unleashing all of Jonas's memories that he's now received onto the town, and the Giver would stay behind and guide those people, I guess, as kind of like a religious leader to kind of guide them through the pain and the joy and kind of give them a context for it. And
at once, the plan is ridiculously specific because they spend about 6 pages describing how Jonas is going to get out of town without anyone knowing that he's gone.
And it's like a heist movie. Like, it's like trunks of cars are involved. Which I didn't even know cars existed in this world until this point. And like just like elaborate like obscuring with ceremonies going on and like a bunch of lying, and then it's all undone like you're getting to by the fact that Gabe is going to be released the next morning.
Well, the plan to get Jonas out is elaborated ad infinitum in this book. What exactly is going to happen with these memories, and how they are going to break their way back into this community, and what the plan is going forward, is not clear. And part of why that's not clear is because we still don't really know what the rules and metaphysics, what the metaphysics involving dreams, or not dreams, memories are in this world. Even by this point in the book, it's very confusing.
Right. I mean, and the movie does, to its credit, kind of, I'll get to why it's not to its credit in a second, does kind of set up the rules a little bit more clearly, in that there is like a physical like bubble border to the town, and like the second Jonas crosses that threshold, like the memories are released back into that bubble and they kind of just land wherever or go into whoever. And then in the book, it's as he gets farther and farther away, he has less and less memories. So it's, I guess, like as he gets farther away, the more go back to the people. But like you said, there's still no mechanism for this at all.
Right. The other thing that to mention about the previous receiver is it sets up the 1-0 Henry moment in the book where the giver reveals that this previous receiver was, in fact, his daughter. It's really played like a big reveal, like the end of an EC Comics horror story. But
it's kind of it's like, why didn't that come up before? I mean, it's not really like... I don't know how that... It doesn't particularly change anything about the book. It's like, well, you guys are still about to do this thing. I mean, it's not like he's remembering it was his daughter or Jonas is kind of convincing him like, hey, your daughter went through this. We need to do this for her. It's never that. It's just like, oh, yeah, and my daughter is the last receiver. And it's like, oh, next chapter.
And as you mentioned, it really should have come up at some point before.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that just you can't imagine it having been brought up when he gave Jonas the earlier receiver's name. He should have said, "Oh, and by the way, that was my daughter."
And when the giver's kind of on board for this whole releasing the memories to the community plan, like. It's a lot less of Jonas convincing the giver and the giver just kind of going one day, hey, we should do this.
Yeah.
Which is weird because, I think it would be more effective if Jonas is the one having to convince the giver at, like, length to convince him and even maybe using the daughter as a tool to do that. But also, it just gets to the point to where we're at 150 pages. We're wrapping up at 200, guaranteed. We need to get a move on and just... get into Act 3, and it really feels like a switch is turned, and it's like, hey, this is the plan, this is what we're doing, let's go. And it felt very abrupt to me. And it just, and serving only the fact that it's a book that needs to move on and not like a kind of organically flowing story.
Yeah, and then we have this kind of a strange final couple chapters here where I think I admire that Lowry, I think, is trying something a little different narratively. She has Jonas escaping with Gabriel on a bike, and they go off and they try to avoid these reconnaissance planes that are out looking for them. And in the wide world outside the community, he comes across animals for the first time, birds he's never seen, you know, before. I think some other, like, was it foxes or squirrels or something? I don't know.
I think it was a squirrel. And the only animal that we know the only actual animal we know they've been introduced to before is fish, because one of the jobs in the community is working at the fish hatchery. But that the young infants up to a certain age are given a comfort object, which is like just a stuffed animal, but they're like, oh, but they have no idea, like an elephant was actually something that ever existed, or that a hippopotamus was something that ever existed, or like a giraffe or whatever. Because they do, when they're escaping from the community and getting farther and farther away, as they get farther away, the road becomes less paved, the landscape becomes more hilly. Which was kind of like, I just did like a long road trip back from Oklahoma to California. And that was like, you know, you start in Oklahoma, super flat. As you move farther west, it gets more hilly. And that's kind of what I was imagining Jonas going through as he kind of goes from these kind of insane plains to like an actual true landscape. And they're starving and thirsty. And one of the ways they eat is by fish from the river, which I was kind of like, I was like, again, how do they have any concept for the idea of what fishing is? But I guess they do have a fish hatchery in the town. But there were no other animals mentioned that you can think of, were there?
No, not at all. The other way that they survive is because the planes have thermal imaging. He gives both of them the memory of being cold, which somehow lowers their body temperature enough to thwart this. But that's a weird superpower that we haven't discussed yet, that these memories can actually affect physical change in the body has never been brought up until this point.
And if that were true, like, we would know that, because one of the early pain memories Jonas gets is like of a sunburn. So right. Like this heat on the skin. So if that heat was really affecting him in any meaningful way that could be read by a thermal image camera, like, he would have a sunburn in the real world, but he does, or in his world, but he doesn't.
Right. And also, to defeat thermal imaging, you would have to go down below, say, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that point, you're dead, pretty much.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, you're well beyond dead, I think.
Yeah. So, but, and they make their way off into this landscape that eventually becomes very snowy. And we leave them off in this very strange, I found very strange, last section. Jonah is climbing up a hill with Gabriel. They're suffering from hypothermia. They're starving. And he finds a sled that seems to be from his first memory. And so I'm left at that point, I'm thinking, is this a mirage? Is this like a dream that he's having as he's dying? But at the end of the book, he and Gabriel are kind of sledding away, and he thinks he sees lights in the distance. And we're left with this kind of a Lady or the Tiger ending about what actually happens to the characters. But as I was reading commentary on this, it seems like everyone who writes commentary on this takes it as read that he actually did find a physical sled and actually did sled away on it. And that just raises more questions in my head. Like, so this memory he had was of this specific sled?
I think even more than that, like, who puts a sled on top of a hill and then walks down?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. It also kind of, and I think it's heavily implied that what they're seeing is like homes celebrating Christmas. I mean, they talk about like the tree in the window.
Right.
Lights. And then real quick, going back to seeing beyond, like at this point, they're pretty much seeing in color because they're far enough away from the community. But so Jonas is seeing beyond was seeing flashes of color. The giver's version of seeing beyond was hearing music. And exactly how he was hearing music in that community is not made clear. But the giver keeps that to himself. He never gives that to Jonas. And at the end of the book, he's hearing what is possibly music for the first time. Well, sure. What is music for the first time, but it's, you know, underplayed. Genuinely 90% of the discussion in my 8th grade class about this book, I feel, was about the ending and whether or not it should be taken as is, or if it was like a, you know, hallucination as he's dying. And I feel like it was a pretty 50-50 split, if I remember, because I mean, that's all we talked about. Like, we never got into any of the other details of this book.
Right. Now it's funny you bring that up, because that's exactly the sort of thing that ate up all the time in high school literature classes, were these like really ridiculous points of plot about what exactly happened rather than theme or style. It was all like, no, wait, did he die at the end or not?
No, that's how I feel like almost every like book you cover in this podcast. I try to think back on like the discussions we had in my classes, and I think with the exception of like my a couple of specific exceptions, I think pretty much everything we read in middle school and everything I read my junior year was like touched on in the most like useless way, and that would have been like dealing with twist endings. Or just kind of big plot points and like how they make you feel, and not, like you said, themes or like what it's like the historical context, which I think is important, which is I think interesting about most books. Although this one, like you said, doesn't have much, but we were able to get to quite a bit in terms of like kind of like the drug use and all that.
Yeah. Now, you want to talk a little bit about the movie? You said you had opinions about the...
Okay, I do. So I tried rewatching it for this podcast, and I couldn't get very far. And luckily, I was kind of busy, so I had kind of excuses not to watch all of it. But the movie kind of has I think an interesting opportunity to do a lot of stuff visually that the book can't. Where like the book had like an advantage where it kind of can keep the color reveal as a twist. The book or the movie can't keep that twist. So it starts black and white. Flashes of color, eventually full color, whatever. And all of the control that the community, all the physical control that the community puts on people, whether it's like seeing color or kind of the stirrings / sexual desires people feel, that all of that is controlled through injections every morning rather than some unknown force. So the movie, something it did well was kind of attribute most of the stuff you see to like something physical happening within the world. That being said, like it totally changed the kind of the rules of the memory, which is where he goes beyond a certain threshold, those memories are released back. And I think the movie, in terms of the ending, pretty much says it's not an hallucination. I think the song they're hearing is like Silent Night or one of the other common Christmas songs. And it just, I don't know, maybe I had less of a good point about the movie than I thought I did, but it's genuinely a bummer of a movie because I think it's a book, again, like a lot of kids like, and I think they might go to see the movie to augment that experience, but I think it undercuts a lot of what the book was trying to do. In terms of surprise, I mean, it kind of feels very much kind of like if you kind of were to give the, if you were to assign kids to write like a play based on this book, like the things it latches onto are kind of the most surface level aspects of it.
Uh huh.
Which is frustrating.
Well, it sounds to me from what you describe, that it's seeking to make literal a lot of the things that happen in the book. And to me, the book is more interesting if it becomes more complicated and more confusing. I think that to the extent that I enjoyed the book, I enjoyed it most when it tried something surprising. I feel as though part of it here is Lowry is not a particularly strong stylist, and I think that is also because she's writing for a younger audience and maybe she doesn't trust them to follow her when she's making some kind of stylistic choices. But when from time to time something is weird and surprising, I felt like there were ideas that I wish she'd gone more with. I like the idea that color is something that only he can see, but I think it required a bit better writing to really pull off, because all that she can pull off in the book is he looks at an apple and it looks different for a second. And
right.
I remember thinking, okay, she's trying something here, but it's not working. I was like rereading that paragraph over and over again and saying, I get that she's wanting to say something. And when they get to the point where they explain that what he sees is color, and later he sees red in his friend Fiona's hair, you know, I think there's a lot that could be done there poetically with why is red the color you see first? What does that mean? How is that associated with desire? Because yeah. Fiona is the girl he has stirrings for, but it's not.
Who's also the love interest in the movie, by the way. Their ages are raised from 12 to 16, and it's kind of much more that road.
I was reading on the back story of this book that this book gets banned a lot because people think that it is too sexy for kids. I'm thinking, like, oh my God, if this is too sexy for kids.
I think it's not that it's too sexy. I think that it's like it implies that kids have sexual feelings and thoughts, which, you know, a large part of, you know, this country especially doesn't want to admit to. And I think, or when they don't want to normalize it either. I think like this book does kind of do that, but it's not a big deal, like you said, in terms of the kind of the way it's presented in the book. But so in terms of banning, the other reasons I also saw were too violent.
Well, they do kill a baby, I guess.
They do kill a baby, yes, and then under like the subheadings would be like euthanasia and like infanticide.
Yeah.
Which, fair enough. But I don't know. It's not like it's... I always have a hard time kind of seeing where those people who want it banned are coming from when they say it's too violent, because it's like it's condemning those things and like in a significant way. I don't know why that's such a bad thing. And I think the answer is because they're not considering that at all. But
in spite of the fact that there are these Christian overtones, the happiest memory that Jonas is given is of a family celebrating Christmas. And at the end of the book, as you say, it seems implied that he's headed towards a home celebrating Christmas. That's as much religion as goes into this book. And while it's a book that deals with a different system for organizing society, religion is neither present in the community, nor is it really posited as much of a... It's not really posited as the alternative to the community either.
Well, I think it kind of is, actually. Well, when Jonas is deciding to leave the village and have these memories cast back onto the community, and he's begging the giver to come with him, and he's like, I need to stay and guide these people, I think he's effectively becoming... like the religious leader of the community, to put all these thoughts into context. It's not going to be like, I'm going to be a priest or a specific Christian minister or any other religion leader, but he's going to provide the function of what a religious leader does. And that's put, history and feelings, pain and passion into like a very specific context where people can kind of get through their lives without, you know, tearing themselves apart. Although I think obviously we know that people can kind of get through that without religion. But I think that's kind of, and I didn't see that when I was reading in eighth grade. That was something I noticed on the reread, where I was like, oh, the giver is staying behind to become a religious leader or the equivalent of one in this community. So it's not overtly like a specific religion or religion, but I think it's that the community is going in a direction that implies religion.
Well, I'll agree to a point, only insofar as, again, I keep thinking about when I read the first chapter and we had the scene of the family sitting around and discussing their days, and everyone was supposed to talk about their feelings. It really feels to me like ultimately this book is a kind of about theories of the mind and of emotion, and it really does feel to me ultimately like a big dig at a therapeutic society, like that somehow being an authentic person means owning your pain and owning your emotions. And I understand that there are people who are very distrustful of, say, again, therapy or antidepressants or any of the many ways in which people try to mitigate the pain of being alive. But I also felt really a little bit of screw you, Lois Lowry. People have actual problems that they have to deal with. And sometimes they deal with it through therapy.
Yeah. So towards the end of the book, now that Jonas has the context of all this, remember, he kind of remembers that very first scene where they're talking about their feelings, like the sharing of the feelings. And so Lily's angry that kid was cutting in line at the playground. And like he kind of retroactively analyzes her anger at like the rule breaking. He doesn't see it as anger. Like, he sees it as like shallow impatience, and exasperation, not anger. So, but now Jonas knows what true anger is, and he knows about injustice, he knows about cruelty, where Lily doesn't. And I think it's more about, being, in terms of therapy, actually talking about your real problems. Like, and I think he does that with The Giver, where he's kind of given these painful memories or these passionate memories or whatever, and he can talk them out with the Giver in a positive way. So I think it's more like a kind of a dig at people who aren't open about how they really feel. But it's all, but again, that metaphor, I mean, that word, that not metaphor, because I'm the one saying that, but that breaks down when you kind of consider that the people who are saying that they feel angry because of the rule breaking, they don't know. Like, they're not being superficial, because that's as deep as they go. But they also have, like, the mother express sadness, and like that angered Jonas because he knew what true sadness and grief was. And he talked about that. I think he spoke about those feelings with the Giver. And I think, and that seems to be kind of effective for him. And I think Jonas sees the value in that, which is why he wants to release these memories onto the community.
I think what you just said there about the metaphor breaks down is a metaphor for this entire book. insofar as this book, it just seems like this book is one tortured analogy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much room for projection. And then the second you try to kind of go deeper with whatever thought you're having, you're like, well, no, because of this, that, the other thing. And like you said, it's kind of wishy-washy with every point it makes, to where you don't know if it's saying this or you don't know if it's saying that, but we know it's at least talking about this. But
But you know, now I'm going to come around and say, given that, I think it's not a bad book for teenagers, because
it
introduces teenagers to that idea of engaging with the themes and the metaphors of a book and arguing with them, and perhaps having a book that isn't necessarily very clear in its program is one of the best things you can give to a teenager.
That's definitely true. Maybe it would be more effective if it had a less ambiguous ending that we focused on less than class. But like, speaking to like the ending real quick, to kind of go for the moment he leaves the community, like to the moment the book ends, like we span quite a bit of time and quite a bit of distance in that, but it really is like maybe 20 pages. I left my physical copy in another state, so I can't actually check the page number. But the reason like that part of the book is incredibly brief, and there's apparently like a logistical reason for that. Like Lois Lowry has said in a couple interviews that I've found that she didn't want this book to be over 200 pages. And she only writes one draft, and she goes back and revises. So she was getting towards the end of this book, and she like needed to knock it out by page 200. So she was kind of rushing through the whole journey away from the community, and she expresses regret in not fleshing that out a bit more.
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways that you can organize yourself as a writer, but I actually have a great deal of respect for a writer who says, by golly, this is going to end at 200 pages. It kills me.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I think the percentage of, if she wants her book truly to be read by kids, I mean, I'm sure a lot more people, you know, if 200 kids are assigned The Giver and 200 kids are assigned Crime and Punishment, I think a much higher number is going to read The Giver based on length alone. not necessarily the quality.
Thanks again to co-host Matt Skuda. You can learn more about what he's up to at mattskuda.com. If you'd like to email, you may do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And one of these days, I might read email on the show, if I ever get any. You can also join us on a Sophomore Lit Facebook page. Just search for Sophomore Lit and ask to join. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. Next time, join us for the poetry of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And remember, everything will be on the final.